Welcome to the Journey of Wholeness podcast. We are a group of passionate individuals who are coaches and mentors here to help inspire, guide, and support you on your journey of wholeness. We know that the journey of wholeness is a lifelong pursuit, and we are thrilled to join you in your journey. We are passionate about sharing our life lessons, wisdom, and knowledge to help you to transform your life. We focus on teaching principles of truth, supporting you in applying those truths, and helping you to live a life full of joy. Okay, welcome everyone to the Journey of Wholeness podcast. We're so excited to have you here. We have a very special guest that I'll introduce in just one moment. My name is Jackie. We also have Heather and Amy with us today, who are part of our Journey of Wholeness team. And our special guest today is Hugh Vail. And we are really thrilled and so grateful that Hugh is spending some of his time with us today. And before we get into Hugh's story, we'd love to kind of paint the picture as to how we met Hugh and what kind of the journey has been to us creating a relationship with him and why he's on the podcast today. And so, and that story begins with Amy, and I'd love to pass the time over to Amy so that she can share her story with us, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. So a couple years back, I was on a week-long camp learning different outdoors and survival skills. And I kept hearing little whispers. Did you go to the horse workshop? And so I made a point to get to this horse workshop and sat through an amazing visual lecture, very insightful into our own inner human workings. And then Hugh does this amazing thing, or did at this particular workshop, where he gathered us all up at the end in the circle and kind of closed out with letting each person share what changed in them, what they learned. And I'm watching him as he does this, and he's turned and he's giving their full attention to each and every person. And it's like you could feel that he was there letting them share whatever needed to come out, and was going to hold that as a perfectly safe space for them to do so. Whatever emotions came up, and he was just emitting love. And so it comes around to me, and I talk and I cry, and I felt safe. And I learned from other people's sharings too, but I was just very impressed with the whole experience. Went away, talked to Jackie about it. Jackie, you have to hear about my experience, and wrote it in my journal, different things like that. It was very much so a personal transformational experience of what I learned. And so thank you, Hugh, for showing up to that particular workshop.
Yeah. It's not always easy to do that, but I mean, I'm glad that you caught on to that. A lot of people maybe don't have the awareness of holding, how difficult it is to hold space for others. And I suppose that's because maybe we don't do such a good job at holding space for ourselves. So maybe that's a self-awareness thing. So I think it's kudos to you on even tuning in or tapping into that.
It's been part of my journey, that's for sure. And I've had excellent friends who have held space for me. So I think that's somewhat easy to recognize. Maybe a question for later in the podcast, but I would be curious to talk a little bit more about holding space for people and how that shows up as difficult, but how it shows up as being worth the intention to do so. But maybe let's just pin that one for later.
Sure. So do you remember what your takeaway was at the workshop? Because at the end, you know, what you're talking about is I do the presentation with the horse, and we see that it as a metaphor for ourselves. If I've done a good job, I've simply helped you see yourself as the horse, right? Learning and growing through struggle, becoming better, being able to learn how to self-regulate difficult emotions, these types of things. And And at the end, I tell a story about, I can tell the story. I don't know if it makes so much sense, but basically it's like, what's this whole metaphor and this whole way of gentling a horse, like what's really in it for the horse? That's a question that gets asked all the time. And there's this bond that horses and humans have, obviously. We've had it from the dawn of time. I mean, since horse showed up and man showed up and they met, they've been helping us plow the fields. They've been helping us go to the battlefields. They've been helping us go to grandma and grandpa's house to deliver the mail. I mean, the whole post office, you know, originally the Pony Express was on horseback. And so here we've had this relationship, I think, with such a beautiful animal as the horse, to be able to help better learn who we are. And so the question I always ask is, I ask everyone this, is at the end of the presentation, if the Mustang were to go back to Creator and report back and say, this is how I elevated man today, because I think that's the answer to what's in it for the horse. I think they're actually helping us become better humans. I think they're helping us align with our wholeness and find our wholeness despite our deficiencies. And so if the Mustang were to return back to Creator and say, this is how I helped, you know, Amy or Hugh or, you know, whoever is in attendance there, what might that Mustang say? And so everyone goes around. So, you know, what she was talking about is how I look at everyone face to face and they say whatever, that what they're doing is they're answering that question. Like, this is what this Mustang taught me today about me and what I need to learn. Hence why we call it medicine, Mustang medicine, because the medicine is already in you. Just like your wholeness is already with you. It's just, sometimes it's hard to take it and hard to, receive it and believe it. And so I guess going back, maybe that's a little bit of context. So going back, do you remember when you were there, what your takeaway was? And I don't mean to put you on the spot because that was a few years ago, but do you remember what your takeaway was on what the Mustang message was back to you?
I do. And probably thankfully for the fact that I was moved enough to write it in my journal, I'm not always that consistent. So I have both the sense that it left with me and the written word to come and help me have that wake back up in me. So I remember almost feeling God seeing through to that whole center, the real me, and the love that was there for me, that existed just as it was, as it is, and that I don't have to, right, change anything or be anything different to have that. And then seeing the connection between how God already has that there for me, so I can feel that same sense of self-worth also.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I was just reading in, I wasn't even reading this. I had I don't know what I was doing. I think maybe it was a dream or something. I woke up at like 3 a.m. This is like 2 or 3 nights ago. And I woke up and I just had this inner knowing. That's probably the best way I could describe it. And my inner knowing was telling me to get up and read the original Greek verse in the New Testament that says, judge not lest ye be judged. And I'd read it before, but I didn't really recall too much. And I had heard it from one of my favorite authors, a guy named Richard Rohr, R-O-H-R. I highly recommend everyone read everything he writes. I find it to be really, really worth reading and worth thinking about. And what he said is that probably the the better translation might sound something like, label not in comparison, lest we be labeled in comparison. But that was a couple of years ago, and I thought that. So a couple nights ago, I wake up and it's like, hey, you need to read this in the original Greek. And that's something that I've been doing for almost 5 years now, is I've been going through and reading the original Greek and translating it into more of my contemporary vernacular. And I'm doing that for my kids to be able to read one day. So this isn't too far outside the norm in my inner knowing to say something like that. That's like pretty standard, because I've been working on this for years. And so anyways, I pull it up, and the Greek word for judge, like to judge, right? It's a verb, it's an action word, is to make a determination as to whether something is right or wrong. And so if we just remove the word judge and just replace it with the definition of the word. Okay, so instead of saying judge not, what we could just say is, do not make a determination as to whether something is right or wrong. That's really, I think, the message. So if you don't make a determination as to whether something is right or wrong, from a labeling standpoint, like labeling in comparison, right? This isn't to say to not have healthy boundaries and to not set those boundaries and to make wise decisions. Judgment coupled with wisdom is a very important thing to do. And so I don't want that to be misinterpreted. But I think to go back to your wholeness and to see things within, I think we all have flaws, but if we could reserve making a judgment or judge not, right? Don't make a determination as to whether the thing you did is right or wrong, labeling and comparing, that's really what's being said. And the solution to that is to have empathy. It's not actually to have an absence of judgment. It's more to have an absence of labeling it good or bad, and really to realize with empathy that I'm on human experience, and I'm a human doing human things, and half this stuff is pretty damn retarded. And that's just all part of the journey, right? And so then there's no labeling it. And if we label it, it's almost impossible to learn from it. That would be if we label it negatively, it's near impossible to learn from it. And I think the challenge that happens is that so many of us go through painful experiences. And when it's a painful experience, it feels like something is lost. That's the definition of sorrow. So one of the things I talk about all the time with guests that come out to our ranch and do our retreats and our workshops, I always ask the question, who here has never experienced sorrow? And nobody raises their hand. And so then I say, okay, well, who here has experienced sorrow? And everyone raises their hand. It's a question I've always gotten 100% the same answer every single time. And so in the human experience, we have very painful things. And in those painful experiences, there's a lot of things that we perceive to be lost, right? And so when we approach these really painful things with the understanding of empathy, then I think we can immediately remove the judgment, because empathy is the antidote to judgment. So when I'm trying to follow this principle in my life, and this is not just a New Testament principle, I mean, this is in the Talmud, you know, for Judaism, this is in the writings of Buddha, this is in the writings of Lao Tzu, in the Tao Te Ching. I mean, this is like really common knowledge across all, you know, belief systems, is that I should reserve labeling and judging things. Empathy is the antidote to judgment. And I think once we can really step into realizing that everyone is just doing the best that they know how to do with the tools they had in that moment, well, then forgiveness automatically comes. A lot of people talk to me all the time about how they're trying to forgive. And I always tell them, if you're trying to forgive, you're aiming at the wrong thing. Because whenever we aim at forgiveness, we never get it. I mean, we can tell ourselves we can get it. We can say, oh, I've really forgiven that person. But what real forgiveness is that there is no judgment and the pain is alleviated and the wound is healed. You forgive automatically once the pain is gone and the wound is healed. Because what's left to be sad, angry, you know, despiteful about if all of that has been restored? And it's empathy that heals those wounds. And so I think maybe even a better thing is what we ought to do rather than what we ought not to do is we ought to lean in with empathy, which is probably one of the most difficult things that I think any of us can do on the human experience.
At least that we're extremely ill practiced at it. It's not a common thing that shows up in our society. I think we have the potential to be very good at it as a people. That's my hope. Part of part of why I join in the work that we do is because I see a community of people that can show up empathetically and without that judgment. And it just, we need the safe places to practice it.
Yes.
Because our gut responses are what we've been taught to call a name, to blame, and to caught up in that criticism and labels and judgment.
Yeah, that those gut responses that you talk about. I mean, what we're really trying to do is just figure out, what am I supposed to do with these difficult emotions that I'm feeling from this pain that I'm experiencing? Pain always comes with this gift basket of our shadow emotions. So I believe we have two types of emotions. We have sunshine emotions and we have shadow emotions. And the sunshine emotions, like happiness and contentment and joy and enthusiasm, you know, those are so easy to lean into and embrace. But we all have the emotions of sadness, jealousy, bitterness, resentment, you know, we have those feelings. And when those feelings pop up, they feel so painful. And so we immediately judge them as, this is not good. Therefore, it came from that experience. So that experience and anyone or anything that is attached to that painful experience is now most likely not good either. And so whenever we're trying to, I think, make those initial gut judgments, is we're trying to actually make sense of the shadow emotions that have been poorly modeled in our life on how to embrace and be at one with. Because that's wholeness too, right? Wholeness is all of my emotions, whether they're sunshine emotions or shadow emotions. I've got to be at one with those without judging why or when or how they showed up. They are invitations for me to realize what they are. And when you can really lean into these painful experiences and not try to push away these shadow emotions, but rather invite them in, one, the data shows that they'll begin to subside within 90 seconds as long as we don't tell a blaming story about somebody or something that's attached to how or why it showed up, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. So you're saying that the 90 seconds is how long a negative feeling takes to kind of work its way through our body if we're not attaching a story in that 90 second interim.
Yeah, because a painful thing happens and then I got to deal with these shadow emotions. And then when the shadow emotions show up, I immediately need to tell a story because the mind thinks in stories. Yep. And so if you would not have done this, well, then I would not be experiencing this. And so automatically I'm putting you at fault for having that have shown up. And it doesn't mean that that's not true, right? I'm not saying that we should all just run around and be idiots and hurt each other and then be like, don't judge me, right? That's obviously ridiculous, but to say like, well, this did happen. And you know what? It happened because that person was doing the very best they could with the tools that they had in that moment. And now this becomes an invitation for me to know myself even a little bit more of how well I can regulate these shadow emotions. And by embracing the shadow emotions at first and saying, thank you, sadness, this is a very sad thing. So my body's actually being very healthy, and this is a healthy response to be sad. The sadness will begin to alleviate once we can find meaning in the experience, right? But the body will start to self-regulate within about 90 seconds, where it'll begin to soften and lessen. If we go back to the blaming story, well, if you would have done what I told you to do, then we wouldn't. Well, now what you've just done is just put yourself back into the cycle. And so the mind doesn't know whether it's happening for the first time or happening for the 90th time. If it's actually happening or if you're just thinking about it happening, the mind, you know, experiences it the same and sends the alarm systems down. So the real question is how do I go through really hard, painful experiences, lean into my shadow emotions, and then realize with empathy that everyone was just doing the very best they can. This allows the pain to not torture me and these freaking cycle stories, but rather to teach me the only way to be taught is through empathy. It's the only way.
That's a golden question, Hugh. How do we do that? My question in response to that is, what have you seen in the work that you do with your horses and your Mustangs that has helped to give you insight in how to actually answer that question?
Well, one of the first things I've gotten so, I say hippie, but probably the word is in tune, that I can actually hear the Mustangs sending messages to me. So, and I like their definition of words better than mine, and sometimes even better than Oxford's. Not to say that Oxford's are bad. It's just sometimes I get a little bit more clarity for my own understanding. And so Socrates said the beginning of wisdom is the definition of terms. And so this is a really loaded statement. First off, you say the beginning of wisdom, well, you have to understand what wisdom is. And wisdom is the ability to apply the knowledge and understanding that we intellectually know. So wisdom is the application of our knowledge into our daily practical lives. That's what wisdom is, which is different than knowing, and it's different than understanding. It's actually being able to apply it. So the beginning of wisdom, the beginning of being able to apply in your daily life the things that you know intellectually, is that we must first have the same terminology and then define those terms the same way. So we have to have the same definition for the same terms or terminology. So trust is one of these words that I've learned from the Mustang. And it's really interesting about trust, because I was, you take a wild horse from the wild. He's got to work 15, 16 miles a day to try to maybe find enough food and water for that day. And then the next day he's got to repeat and do the same process. And this is because many of the herds are pushed out to the shadowlands of public property, you know, or public land. And there's just not, it's more deserty, it's more arid in a lot of these herds. And so that's why they have to work so far and so long every single day to do it. And so you would think, well, I'm going to take this wild Mustang and I'm going to go provide him a better home and a safer place to live. There's not going to be predators inside of my barn. The water's going to be 5 feet away from him. Every morning I'm going to come out, and in the evening I'm going to come out and I'm going to feed him the highest nutrition, best food that the earth grows. And then intermittently between that, I'm going to feed him apples and carrots and and maybe even some like healthy little cookie treats, you know? And so you think, well, this is going to be a really great life. And what was so interesting to me is after a couple of weeks working with a Mustang, going out and doing this whole thing, the trust was not growing as much as I thought it would. And having worked with many Mustangs, one day I was thinking about this, and, you know, in the beginning days of being with a Mustang, if you open up that gate, he will bolt back to the wild, to that dangerous place that he's barely surviving in. It's instantaneously. I mean, without thought, he'll just take off. And I don't know how to describe it, but one day I was just thinking about my horse, my personal horse is River. And the only way I could describe it is like what I heard him say to me, like in my inner knowing, is he said that this was because trust is good, multiple good experiences over long periods of time. So trust is multiple good experiences over long periods of time. And so now if you go out to the pasture with River and you open up the gate, he might walk out to the front lawn, right? And then as soon as he's thirsty, he's going to go back to his little stall and go get his drink. Like, he's not going back out to the wild because there's been enough trust that's been established in multiple. And so he's changed his environment and his understanding of his environment. And I think that's really hard and challenging for a lot of us, because how love was defined for us growing up was probably pretty damn dysfunctional, right? And anytime that we had these shadow emotions show up, our parents were doing the very best they could with the tools that they had in that moment. But they probably told you things like, oh, if you're crying, I'll give you something to cry about, right? Stop crying or I'll give you something to cry about. You know, toughen up, you know, buck up, those kinds of things. And those don't teach and model us kids growing up on how to actually embrace the emotion. And within like 90 seconds, so the next time your child is crying, like, just say, oh my gosh, that probably really does hurt. And that, you know, and honor what they're actually feeling and just let them sit in that. And about a minute and a half, 2 minutes later, they'll be on to something else. And you see that. Well, when we are told to stuff it down and to push it down and to avoid it, what we're really being taught is how to try to avoid pain at all costs. And actually, I was reading Brené Brown has her new book out. It's called Atlas of the Heart. I don't know if you've all read it yet. Yeah. Let me pull it up on my phone and I'm going to find this quote. She says, people will do almost anything to not feel pain, including causing pain and abusing power. People will do almost anything to not feel pain. I think that's very natural for us to do that. And I think one of the biggest challenges that we have to learn is to lean into it's I don't even know if it's the pain as much as it is the gift basket of shadow emotions that pain brings with it. It's the emotional impact that I think I really want to get away from. The pain you kind of know will subside, but it's the emotions that like almost re-trigger. And I think that's what that's how I would define what we're working on in our retreats now. So we did hundreds of workshops. We had thousands of people come out. And then we went down and partnered with a 200-acre ranch, which you guys have been down to, so that we could now have people and guests come out and stay at our ranch. And that's so that they can get experiences of how to learn to embrace and love the shadow emotions, the difficult, dark things, so that you stop trying to avoid and ignore the pain and more so just be like, okay, this is going to be a teacher for me. So I need to face and feel it. And how do I do that? Because it was never really modeled that well to most of us.
Okay, so I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. With everything, I've loved what you've shared. Just want to say that, first of all. I'm sitting over here. Nobody can see me, but I'm like, keep nodding my head. Anyways, my question for you, though, is as we look at like leaning into the pain, right, and stepping into those shadow emotions, allowing ourselves to feel that. I had a friend of mine once explain it. She's like, it's like allowing ourselves to walk through the sludgy pond instead of just standing and being stuck in the muck, which if we try and shove it down, right? Mm-hmm. But if we walk through it, if we allow ourselves to feel it, we walk through it. So my question for you is, what would you share with somebody who is struggling like with depression or something like that, who hasn't found their way out of those shadow emotions yet?
Well, I mean, depression's a real thing. I've had it. And you go through some really heavy stuff, and the heaviness is what presses us down, right? That's the depressing down, is that the soul feels heavy. So there has to be a way to lighten that. And I think when we chase I can only speak for myself. You know, obviously therapists are better equipped and psychologists are better equipped to answer these for individual people. They need to go see like, you know, their therapist about this. But generally speaking for myself, what I found myself trying to do with my own depression is trying to chase the lightness. Meaning if I could have something that felt really light in my life or pleasurable in my life, then the pain and the heaviness would go away. And it never really did. And what I found was that the more I leaned into the root of the problem, the root of the pain, where it was at, figuring out what the root was, then embracing it rather than trying to make it go away. If that makes sense. The challenging part is to embrace sadness without becoming sad. I think when we become sadness, we are depressed. But when we can feel sadness without becoming sadness, or we can feel, you know, guilt without becoming shameful, when we can feel the emotion and say, you know what, this is a healthy thing, I should be feeling this. I don't think we do that. I didn't do that very well for decades. So I didn't give myself a lot of space to experience grace. That's how I would define that. I was really hard on myself. And I was really hard on myself, and still have a tendency to be hard on myself, because in the home that I was raised in, with parents doing the very best they knew how to do with the tools that they had, we didn't have a lot of safe spaces or safe, there wasn't a lot of emotional safety. We weren't told that we were enough. We weren't, when we had really difficult things show up, we had very superficial conversations about it, or no conversation at all. So there wasn't any like normalizing on what our experiences were. So when it's not normalized, then, you know, Brené Brown talks about this, when it's not normalized, then we start to internalize it, and we start to think that it's me. And so if I start to think it's me, then I'm going to lean into shame. And when I lean into shame, I'm operating on a premise that I am the problem, because I don't really know what normal is. And so all these problems that are coming around must be because of me, because I'm internalizing it. And so as a child, if I learn to internalize this, and then I start to go through other natural, normal, hard, painful experiences in life, I'm going to continue internalize it, that it's me. And that will depress a person, I think, really, really quickly. And again, that's my story. That's how it was for me. And opening up communication about this is what I'm feeling, identifying why I'm feeling this way. A friend of mine said to me one day, surprising. I mean, he's like the guy that checks all the boxes and does all the things the right way. And his LinkedIn profile looks incredible. And his resume is awesome. And, you know, you just think he's like a real life Clark Kent walking around the neighborhood. And he said to me one day, he said, my soul, how did he say it? It was very poetic. He said, the engine of my soul runs on the fuel of shame. I had no idea. Like, I just had no idea that's, and that came from an inner knowing, a self-knowing about what he had believed about himself through experience. And that's just because we're just not modeled how to talk about really difficult things. And so if you don't talk about these really difficult things and you don't learn how to just embrace them and love them and be like, yep, and then that's normal, and then let it pass on by. And that's part of your wholeness, right? So your wholeness is that you have flaws and you have deficiencies. I think one of the challenges that I've had is that I'm good looking, I'm articulate, I train wild horses. I like reading the Greek New Testament, right? I mean, like, I can quote Brené Brown endlessly all day long. These are kind of something. I love guns. I hang out with Navy SEALs. I worked with an organization that rescued kids from child sex trafficking, did really great things, right? It's like, oh, it's like a lot of good things about me. And then you start helping people identify their shame and getting rid of the blame and the shame story. And some people accidentally put you on a pedestal. And the problem with putting someone on a pedestal is that it removes you from your own, like, you are the center. The center will always hold. And that's where we place people who, you know, we think are going to come and rescue us or save us or who are really helping us. And so once you put someone on a pedestal, the challenge is that they can't have flaws and they can't have deficiencies. And so when you find out that I have flaws and I have deficiencies, or if I put you on a pedestal and I find out that you have flaws and you have deficiencies, well, now you're not on the pedestal anymore. And I have no idea what to do with this, right? I mean, this would be like the Christian narrative, figuring out that Jesus actually had flaws and deficiencies. I mean, I think like half the world would like come crumbling into depression because they would be like, well, if he's not going to save us, then who's going to save us, right? I mean, these are like really challenging thoughts to work with. And so that just has been a challenge that I've learned from, is to not ever put anybody on a pedestal, simply because everyone is human and we're all learning and doing the very best that we can. And so this gives enough grace and space for the empathy story to get worked out in a painful circumstance.
I appreciate that. Thank you. One thing that I keep as you're talking about is that empathy, often we need to direct towards our, when we talk about forgiveness, we have to talk about forgiveness for other people. And I think it's really important when we remember that that's very applicable to ourselves as well. And I think it actually needs to start with ourselves, having that empathy for ourselves, and then we can turn it outwards.
I don't think it's possible to have more empathy for someone other than what you have for yourself. Like, if you have level 4 empathy, I don't know what level 4 means, but, you know, let's say it's on a scale and you have level 4 empathy and you think that you have level 6 empathy for other people, I don't think that's true. I think you have level 4 empathy for yourself, and therefore you only have level 4 empathy for others.
I agree completely with that. Okay. So one question we've talked about, since I'm currently unmuted, I'll ask it. You touched on this just a minute ago. Actually, you've touched on it multiple times. You keep, as we talk about wholeness, what is your definition of wholeness?
My definition of wholeness is something that came from the Mustangs. I don't remember the exact experience. I just remember I was out with a couple Mustangs and it just came so clearly. It's like I can hear their soul talking to my soul. And it just came clearly to me. And what I heard was, to own your strengths without arrogance and love your deficiencies without insecurity.
Will you say that one more time?
Yeah, to own your strengths without arrogance and love your deficiencies without insecurity. So I thought about that a lot. And the deficiency is not the problem. It's the insecurity that attaches itself to the deficiency that says it's a problem. And this is really just gets into our ego, because the ego wants two things. The ego wants either something or someone, whether that's you or another person, to be inferior or superior. Which goes back to not making a determination as whether something is inferior or superior, whether something is right or wrong, evil or wicked, right or righteous. And so it's to land in the middle and be in neutrality. And so if I can get my ego to just come into the middle, then I can have harmony in my understanding and in my knowing, despite still having flaws and imperfections.
I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah, I just want to share that that is a very powerful awareness and principle and concept and definition of what wholeness is, and way to conceptualize it. And it invites so much love and empathy for ourselves and honoring yourself and the positive and the things that are not so positive, right? The things that are those shadow sides, the things that we're proud of, right? But it's honoring the whole. And maybe that's the whole, I mean, that's the definition of wholeness, right? But it's the light and the dark in both of us, because they both serve a purpose. So I love that. Thank you.
Yeah.
So one of my hopes is that as we consider what wholeness is, that we can help the people who listen to this podcast and who join us on the journey of wholeness and join our community, that they'll begin to take in like those applicable steps, right? Like, oh, here's this cool conceptualization, but how does that change myself? How does that change my relationship with myself? How does that change then my relationship with others? So maybe you can answer this in relationship to your workshops and retreats. How does it go from that philosophical side to the application? And how could our readers do the same thing? How can they take this conversation and then start to apply that this is what I can do to live more fully from my wholeness?
Yeah, so we do that in a couple, like two different ways, kind of umbrellaed under activities. So the first activity that we do is when you come out to a retreat, you get assigned your own horse. So, and there's kind of a cool little spiritual thing that, like a ceremonial calling, so to speak, where you go bond with a particular horse, and whichever one you end up bonding with is the one you'll spend the four days with. And the horses are safe, but not flawless. So we can go ride them and they're not going to buck and bolt and kick and bite. And they have developed their own inner peace to not have any of those issues. However, they're still going to be in their character growth and their development just like humans. So horses have the same thoughts, feelings, and emotions as humans do. So we're working with horses that know how to regulate their difficult emotions and their fears, and they have tremendous confidence, but they're still on their own journey of you know, being themselves and growing and developing. And so you get your own horse, and there's just some goofy stuff that shows up. Sometimes I've actually seen people fall off the horse and not really anything was happening. They just thought like, oh, I better dodge this tree, you know, because I don't know that horses don't actually want to run into a tree, you know, or walk into a tree. And so it kind of looks like they're heading for it. And then the person will like try to avoid, then they'll slip and fall off. And then the horse, you know, just walks around, and it's funny, but these become messages. So every day we go out and we try to do what I call the sunset in the saddle. And so about sunset time after dinner, we go out and on a ride and we journal and we do breath work and we do yoga and we do meditations. But the journey with the horse always brings stuff up. So that's one of our first activities. The other activity that I really like that I think addresses that question is I have people write a letter to themselves. And the person that they really think that they are. And usually that is not as, usually there's quite a bit of shame and blame in that letter. And so they write that letter to themselves about who they are and how they wish they could be better. And what we see in that letter then, and we do this either individually or we can do it in front of the group if they feel courageous and vulnerable enough. And usually everyone does, because it's come on, we're all here for the same damn reason. Let's get on with it and lean into each other and build a community and get vulnerable. And so we rewrite that letter. So we take that letter, and I have a formula that I teach the people. And we go and identify where they're complaining, where they're blaming, and where they're shaming. And then we rewrite the story from there. So we edit that story. And so when the story is rewritten, it's written, instead of complaining, we find gratitude, which is appreciation for everything that is. And instead of blaming, we lean into accountability. And accountability is the ability to account for what happened without finding fault. That is a very, very challenging activity, to be able to have the ability to account for what happened without finding fault. And a lot of people it's so easy for them to find fault in themselves, or it's easier for them to find fault in someone else, but that's just a mirror. So if you're finding fault in someone else, you know, then really all you're doing is just showing us where your weakness is and where you need to lean in and do some healing, which is fine. That's like what it's all about. And so, and then also identifying the places where there's shame inside the letter and rewriting those parts with empathy. The most challenging part that I've seen with people is that they struggle to answer the question whether or not they feel like they're doing the very best they can do. People with shame will always say, oh, I could do a little bit better. And people with empathy will say, yeah, I am actually doing the very best I can do. Now, none of that has to be impressive, right? Like, I can be doing some really dumb stuff and causing a lot of pain in other people's lives. But that is still the very best that I know how to do. It's just like, can I own that part? Can I really own that deficiency? And can I love that deficiency? Can I show it love and embrace it, face it, and feel it without any insecurity about it? that's really, really challenging to do. It's a simple formula, but it is so difficult to do. And usually it takes a mentor who's able to have done that in their own life. It obviously takes a mentor who's been able to do it in their own life. And then they say, well, here's the thing is I did this. And then this story will come out about why they're a bad person. So now the story is supposed to provide this evidence of why you're bad. You did this or that, or, you know, what, there's a gajillion freaking stories that are out there. And then if we can go back and say, well, we're not going to judge that. We're not going to make a determination about whether that was right or wrong. What we are going to do is just say, of course you did that. Let's go look at the wounds, the emotional wounds that existed long before that thing ever showed up in your life or you did that. And that's where people have never really done. They've never really had an opportunity to dive back in and say, where are those wound, those emotional wounds at? And emotional wounds cannot heal when we are in the wounded story. And the wounded story always complains about the pain. Complaining is just a way of talking about pain. All I'm really trying to do is just to alleviate just a little bit of the pain that I'm having. And so when I complain, it's a way to kind of numb the distress that I'm feeling inside. And as soon as I complain, I'm going to find fault in the circumstance, because when you complain about it, you'll find what you're looking for, which is something wasn't enough. And so to blame is to find fault, and to shame is to identify it as not enough. And so once I'm complaining, blaming, I'll be shaming as well. And so it's to help people get out of that wounded story, because that's what the wounded masculine or the wounded feminine does. And that's why they can't heal, is they sit in the wounded story. And the wounded story says, I've got to have someone else be at fault, and I've got to have someone else not be enough, because what happens is that brings attention, and attention feels like love when you don't have empathy for yourself, right? And so we'll choose the attention, because at least that will feel like something. And so I don't know how to self-soothe. I've never been modeled that before. And I've identified, you know, and the engine of my soul is ran on shame, because if I don't perform or I'm not good enough, then, you know, then this is how I've been shown love. I check off boxes. If I got good grades in school, I got great attention and love from my family. There's nothing wrong with that, but we're just not modeled it in the most healthy way. But we're always modeled it by people who are doing their very best with the tools they have. And so there's a way to do it better. So these are activities that we dive into. And we also have a therapist, you know, so if something really does come up, really does become a challenge, like, we have a therapist that they can chat with. And because I'm not a therapist, right? I'm just this long-haired hippie who shovels horse shit and has metaphors. Like, that's really all that I am. And I go down my own little healing journey, and I have no problem diving into my own pain and my own shadows. And if I have a couple superpowers, that's definitely one of them. And so then I just kind of expect people, like, hey, let's go for it. Like, let's go. Like, it turns out it's not as bad as what you thought it was going to be. In fact, it's quite beautiful. And that's the experience that people have, is they're like, oh my gosh, I thought that if I faced and felt all of this, that what I would find is evidence that I really am not enough, and there really are faults within me. And it's like, they never actually find that. That turns out to never be true. It's never true.
That's amazing.
We're both unmuted to say the exact same thing at the exact same time. Take it away, Amy.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to kind of summarize, because I heard so much goodness in there, and the workshops and the retreat sounds like a beautiful symbolic journey to learn these things. And for us, just listening, I heard that you do this journey with the horses, And we may not have a horse, but we have our journey, right? So whatever's showing up on our journey, the curriculum of life that shows up for us, we can let those things come up. Like, hey, thanks, horse, for bringing this up for me. I needed to work through that. Or, hey, thanks, husband, for bringing this up for me. I needed to work through that. Or, hey, thanks, traffic jam, for bringing this up for me. I needed to work through this. So, and then just tying this back to what you said earlier, that even if what's coming up is a sunshine emotion, great. If it's a shadow emotion, don't run from it either, because we can learn to acknowledge it in the same way that we might have more practice doing with a sunshine emotion. So I hear that, you know, our journey in our curriculum of life being what shows us what we can learn each moment.
Well, I love that you use the word curriculum, because a couple years ago when I was starting the workshops, I was trying to develop curriculum. And there's no way to develop curriculum. There's just no way to do it. You can write books about it and you can write workbooks about it, but you can't really write a good curriculum for someone who's healing their emotional wounds. I don't think you can actually do it. What you can write is principles and you can write out activities, but you can't write a curriculum that each workshop is going to follow and each guest is going to go down through the list, because everyone is so different. And I got the name Mustang Medicine from a corporate executive who was at a spiritual retreat that I was contracted out with to go be one of their parts and one of their experiences. And she came and she worked with one of the Mustangs. And after the retreat was over, they got my contact information and they ended up coming over to my facility and visiting the horses again. And she's big time executive out of New York. And she said, "Your Mustangs were like medicine to my soul." And I had been doing the workshops for almost a year and didn't have a name for it. And I tinkered around and tried to partner with a couple different people and just none of it kind of ever really landed. And so that's how I ended up landing on Mustang Medicine, was because of what she said. Now, fast forward about a year later, I go back to her because she's incredibly intelligent. And I said, "I can't write the dang curriculum." And she's like, "Well, no, of course you can't." And I said, "What do you mean I can't? I'm smart. I'm really well-read. I have hundreds and hundreds of people coming over and doing all of these workshops at the facility. And I mean, they're all having experiences like what you had, and everyone's having these." And she said, "Yeah, but who's having the same experience?" And I was like, "Well, everyone's having their own individual takeaways and they're getting their own little downloads and getting all that, their own little thing." And she said, "Yeah, exactly. So like, how many people have you had?" And at the time, I think I'd had like 1500 people come through it. You know, I'm like, "Well, there's been quite a few." And she said, "So you can't write a curriculum 1500 different times, because you never know the person that's coming, you know, to participate." And she said, "What you do really well is you create this beautiful metaphor that's a symbolism that draws out the next dose of medicine they need for themselves. And they are their own curriculum and they know their curriculum better than anybody else. And so that just surfaces and bubbles up. And you have the ability to work with that and help them embrace that and love that and find empathy for whatever is showing up." And she's like, "And that's what you do." And I realized, oh, I don't create curriculum. I simply have correct principles and a tremendous amount of empathy. And I hold space, and then people are their own curriculum. And so that's really hard to get people to come out to a workshop or a retreat and be like, "Well, we have fun activities we're going to do, and the curriculum is you." And people are like, "I feel like a damn mess and I'm lost. And so this is going to be terrible." It's like, nope, it's actually going to be really amazing. And, you know, it always turns into something really beautiful and really amazing. But yeah, it's a good, that makes me think of the curriculum, or I stopped trying to write the curriculum, that people are their own curriculum. I think people are their own healers. I think people are their own medicine. That's our whole tagline, is you are the medicine. You know, I am my medicine and you are your medicine. And that's a journey I had to go down with all this.
That's a part of your creation of your Mustang medicine experience that I hadn't heard before. And to hear you say, though, and I just have to be honest, like, you are your own medicine, that hits a spot. And I want to maybe tease it out with you for a little bit. Yeah. Because I believe that we heal greatly in relationship with others.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, there's a part of me thinks, oh no, like, we can't just go out and just do this all on our own and have that overly dependent or overly independent mentality.
Yeah.
We lose out on the healing that happens in relationship, in that context of a mentor or somebody can hold space with you. So maybe would you tease that out a little bit for me? Like, what's the difference between being our own curriculum and having that relationship component that is also important?
Well, there is no difference. It's exactly as you said. Like you just gave the answer to it. So any virtue taken in excess becomes a vice. And so you're always trying to be, Aristotle called it the golden mean. It's like right in the middle. And so if you think about it this way, if you like drew a line out like a continuum, and let's say on this side of the continuum, or this side of the line, is you have like a, you have, that's my ringtone. I thought that was on silent. It's a good song. I really like the Zac Brown Band. I hope everyone will go buy their albums and listen to their, follow them on Spotify. I think I've had that ringtone for probably like 10 years now. So if you have, if on this side you have, let's say you got like a helicopter parent, and over here you have a tyrant, right? You just have like a over aggressive parent who's just a tyrant. What we're trying to be is in the middle, because in the middle, what we have is gentleness and firmness in boundaries. So we want to have both. We want to be gentle and we want to be firm. And so too much gentleness and firmness, both being virtues, too much gentleness will then take you over to being a helicopter parent, right? And likewise, too much firmness will take you over to being a tyrant. And so what you've got to do is let them balance each other out. So I think, though, what it means to your point is, when I say you are the medicine, the Chinese proverb says, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And teacher being like mentor. I love that you use the word mentor. I think that is what we need, is we need mentors. Without a mentor, what you have is you have trial and error, right? And so from like a physicist perspective or a science perspective, trial and error can be up to or greater than 5 times more effort than having a mentor. So in other words, if you get a mentor, it'll save you 5x the amount of effort that what you'll end up learning on your own. So mentorship is actually just a more efficient way of doing it. Even reading books is still a form of mentorship, because they're not your original thoughts. You're trying to glean off of what someone has learned and has read. And so you are the medicine can be interpreted like over independence, right? Which then you become a lone wolf, and that never actually works out because it's too excessive in that virtue of independence. However, the reason that the mentor or the teacher appears when the student is ready is because if the teacher appeared before the student was ready, the student won't get anything out of it. So you are your own medicine means nobody can come in and learn it for you. No one can come in and do the work for you. No one can lean in. They're your emotions. They're your experiences. And you're the one that's going to have to wrestle with that. And what you'll find out is that you are whole and you are magnificent, way beyond what you ever thought. And I like to use the New Testament because I'm more read in that than the other belief systems scriptures, even though I've read the Bhagavad Gita. I've, you know, reading the Talmud right now. I've studied with, I've gone to Shabbat many times with Jews, right? I'm a huge fan of Buddha. Tao Te Ching is like one of my favorite writings, but I still use the New Testament a lot because I think all of it contains, I think each one of those belief systems contains the proper message. It's just easier for me and my background and the way that I was raised to look at the New Testament. The point being is in Matthew chapter 5, verse 48, I think it's grossly misinterpreted in today's contemporary vernacular. What I mean by that is what it says is, be therefore perfect. And what you and I or the listeners might actually hear is be therefore flawless. Because to us, the word perfection means flawlessness. But that's actually not what it says in the original Greek version. What it says is be therefore whole, realizing that you are complete, lacking no parts. And so that says something very, very different than flawlessness. So if we were to translate the word perfection, perfection is actually wholeness, not flawlessness, right? And so here's also what it's stating. It's saying, be ye therefore whole. What it's not saying is become whole. What it's saying is you already are whole. And so if you believe in an eternal spirit inside of you, that your body is like driving your human body, the soul, so to speak, I believe that we did not come to earth to become perfect. I believe that we came to earth because we already are perfect. And what we want is an experience with human emotions. And it requires to have a body with that. And if you look at all the dumb shit we do, it's because of human emotions. Either we're wounded with our emotions or we don't know how to process and handle our emotions. And if you look at all the great things that we do, it's because of our human emotions. And so for me, I was sitting under at the ranch. This is about 4 months ago. I was meditating. The Milky Way goes right across the sky. And so we're out. Our 200 acres is planted in the middle of about 1 million acres of public land. So we have zero light pollution out there. So you can see the stars brilliantly. And so one night I was walking through our campsite. We have cabins and then we have campsites, and I prefer to usually stay in the campsite because it's easier to, you know, light campfires and sit around and play music and everything till 3 o'clock in the morning if we're out in the campground area. So I'm out on the 200 acres and I just am so mesmerized by the Milky Way that I literally laid in the desert sand and just like stared at it. And just, I was in total awe. And while this was happening, this is what I heard inside of me, is like my inner knowing all of a sudden started talking to my ears and my heart. And I was like, oh yeah, I remember that. And my inner knowing said, emotion is the reason and virtue is the way. And so it's like, well, why am I here? What am I doing? What is the purpose of this whole experience? And I believe the experience is with emotion. Because if you take any experience that you've had in life, just look back at any experience and remove the emotion. So I usually say like going on your first date, Maybe it was your first kiss or the first time you rode a roller coaster. Like say you ride that roller coaster, what would that roller coaster feel like if you removed all of your emotions? What would it feel like to be betrayed if you had no emotions? So emotion is the reason that's driving all of it. And if we already were perfect, and that's why we came here, is to have this experience, then we're not here to become anything. We're here to walk the journey with human emotions. So how do you take that journey? Virtue is the way to journey with your human emotions. So emotions is the reason, virtue is the way. Virtue is the way because what virtue means is character excellence. So if I find myself shaming, I can use the character excellence or the virtue of empathy to offset that. If I am impatient, I can use the virtue of patience to offset that and to find harmony in my life. So it's not about avoiding, it's about developing the virtues or the character excellences in the experience with the shadow emotions. And in that, what you find is your wholeness, but you also find your inner peace. I think that's the message that Jesus is saying at the end of the Last Supper, when he says, "My peace I give unto you, not as the world giveth, give I unto you." In my opinion, what he's really saying is, I have demonstrated to you how to be with the shadow emotions. I was a man of sorrow, well acquainted with grief. I was abandoned. I was abused. I was betrayed. I was rejected. I was spit on. I was despised of all men, and I have inner peace. And I demonstrated how to have that inner peace. What he did is he developed and used all of the difficult, painful, emotional experiences to learn about himself and to realize everyone is just doing the very best they can do. And so he comes from a place of empathy. And therefore, there is no complaining, no blaming, and no shaming of himself or of anybody else. And when he gets to that point, you have inner peace. And so what he's modeled and mentored is the way of virtue with human emotion. I think this is also what he's saying when he says, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." I think what we would say is, everyone's just doing the best they know how to do with the tools they have. Right? Which Brené Brown says the same thing. Right, that's what the data is showing. And so you already are whole. Like that's the whole, going back to Matthew 5:48, be therefore whole, like own your wholeness. So what is it, your wholeness? Own your strengths without arrogance and love your deficiencies without insecurity. If you can embrace the insecurity, you're not going to all of a sudden become apathetic and be like, "Well, I'm not going to improve this in any way, shape, or form." But there's this philosophical approach to what gets me is what gets my attention is what gets me. So if your deficiency is what gets your attention, you're probably just going to get more of the deficiency. So if you wake up in the morning and you think, "Ugh, I'm so depressed." Well, then you become depressed, right? And so it becomes self-fulfilling prophecy because what gets me is what gets my attention is what gets me. But if you say, "Whew, I feel depressed," that's okay. I've been going through a really hard month this month, or it's been a really hard year this year. Of course I feel depressed. Like this is very healthy and normal. Thanks for being healthy and normal, right? Nobody is, so many people, I shouldn't say so many, but I have had experience with myself. I'll say it that way. I've had experience with myself where I wondered, would I be apathetic because I was empathetic towards everyone, including myself? And what I realized is empathy never generates apathy. it simply gives us the space and the grace to continue to find our wholeness. And I think then we find our emotional healing, and only more character excellence comes out as a result.
I absolutely loved that about, well, I have so many quotes written down right now. I'm writing as fast as I can. But what you're talking about with empathy, and it makes me think of what we talked about earlier with holding space. In order, my personal opinion, and I would love your thoughts on it, but to be able to hold space for another person or for ourselves, that they're there. And I just want to say really quickly, you know, when I had the opportunity to come out and meet you, I would say that holding space is one of your superpowers. Like, I could feel that. Jackie and I talked about that as we left. I'm like, he is really good. And it was before I even knew Amy's full story of her experience of meeting you. But just standing there with you, I could feel that you just held space and you knew how. So I would love to know your thoughts on that. And I believe, Amy, if there was more to your question, please add that in.
I'm so glad we brought this back full circle. It really was essentially that, right? Like, it's not easy. Hugh admitted that himself. But how can we cultivate that in ourselves so that we can offer that to others more?
Yeah, and what I would say is that I hold space for myself really well. And I think because of that, I can hold it for other people really well. The hardest person to hold space for is yourself, because you know what you know, and you also know what you don't know. And it's really hard to be gentle with yourself when you did something that was not in alignment with what you know about that thing. Right. But I hold space really well. And the reason I hold space really well for that is because I come from it, from believing that I'm always doing the very best that I can do. And things always seem to work out, despite the deep, deep sorrow and painful experiences and losses that I have felt like I've experienced and have experienced. And so I think the first thing is that I hold it really well for myself, and therefore I can hold it for others. The thing that solidifies and fortifies that is I do not believe I'm anyone's savior. I don't believe I'm anyone's rescuer. I don't believe I'm anyone's healer. I believe I can rescue myself with the help of a mentor. I believe that I can heal myself with the help of a mentor. And so I believe that I can share what I have learned and maybe kind of take a little bit of a role of a mentor or a guide for people as they heal themselves or they rescue themselves. So when I'm holding space, I'm really just like looking at people. And if you want to know the honest truth, I'm like, okay, get it. Go do the work. Like, I did it. You go do it. And I just have no problem believing in people to that degree. But it's also because I've believed in myself to that same degree.
So I'm hearing that maybe perhaps the greater challenge for people is before they hold space for others is to come back and hold that for themselves and learn to sit with their shadow emotions instead of running away from them.
Oh, yeah.
Did you add anything else to that?
No, I think you said it perfectly. And when you've really done the work and you've really been able to identify the complaining, blaming, and shaming stories, the wounded story in yourself, and you go sit with other people in this kind of space, they can sniff out where I'm not authentic. If they've done the work and I haven't done the work, they sniff it out. Likewise, if they're thinking that they're, you can hear it in the way they talk, that they maybe think they're a guru, or they think that they're someone else's healer, or they're someone else's rescuer, instead of just someone else's space holder and like thought adjuster, like perhaps we should see it from this angle, right? Like that's kind of the only thing that we really are. then it's just like, oh, your ego's wrapped up in it. And that's because somewhere inside you're not okay with some shadows, and you think that this is what's going to make you safe. So you're trying to make other people safe through you because you haven't really found it yourself. I don't know. It's like a really big, powerful mirror. It's like at pretty deep levels. And I just don't buy into any of that. And so you can always tell the real people who have done the shadow work is, and it's a process. It's not like a one and done kind of a thing. I redo shadow work because I worked it out and I got the empathetic healed story. And then a couple months later, I got wounded again, and then it triggered again, and I fell back into complaining, blaming, and shaming. And then I got to go redo the work. But it just gets easier and easier to redo it, especially when you know what's on the other side of the shadow work is just lots of light.
Well, I for one can tell you that through this conversation, I am so excited to go and show up for myself in that way, to hold space for my shadow emotions, to work through the shame and blaming stories a little bit more. As we get to the point of wrapping up here, I want to ask you to share. Jackie, Heather, and I show up as mentors for our group, and you show up for mentors for those who show up at your workshops and your retreats. So for people who decide that they want you to be a mentor in their life, I want them to be able to find you. How does somebody get a chance to come and work with you and your horses?
Yeah. So probably the best thing to send me a message on Instagram or Facebook. Really the easiest way is Instagram. MustangMedicine.com is our Instagram handle. And I will say about our workshops and our retreat, our workshops a little bit different, but our retreats, they're for people who really want to look into, do the shadow work. A lot of retreats, which I love, I'm just not one of them. We are adding a little bit more in, but a lot of retreats, in my opinion, people, they pump you full of dopamine and serotonin for the whole retreat. They cater your meals and they give you little gifts and they, you know, they tell you how wonderful and how great you are. You know, and these are all wonderful things, and you need to go to those retreats, and there's some great retreats out there. So if anyone's looking for great retreats and they're like, I need to start at that one, it's like, I can point them in those directions. I have a lot of friends in the space. But once you've kind of been to those again and see what happens, and the reason I'm not it is I'm like a deeper level of like inner knowing. And so if you're coming to like find lots of dopamine and serotonin and be told that you're great, wonderful, and beautiful, and that's what you really want me to say, like, that's not really, I want you to look at your shadows. I want you to see the beauty in your shadow, not the beauty in your light and the beauty in your beauty, because there's other retreats that are really good at helping people get to that stage. So we're a challenging, for someone who hasn't done some of that work, we can be a lot. Because I'm like, you're whole, you're amazing, you're independent, let's go freaking get it. And usually I say the F word and I kind of just get straight to the point. And I'm hiring women that are coming in to soften that a little bit more. And they're bringing little gift baskets. So when you show up, you know, you'll have your little gift basket. So I'm not opposed to it. It's just not me. But I do want to make that clear, is people who have done some work and they're like, I keep going to these amazing dopamine, serotonin filled retreats. And then I come home and then my life feels like garbage again. And I'm repeating the pattern. So I got to go to these happy feel good retreats every 6 months to try to make it through the next 6 months. To me, I'm like, how about we look at the pattern that's showing up in your life and really get into the shadows of why your life is that way? Let's dig deeper and let's heal those wounds that you're repeating these patterns. You're not stuck. You're just living in a pattern that you're blind to. And it's okay. I do it too. And so let's dig into that. And all of our negative patterns come from emotional wounds. So let's go look at the wound. Let's go rewrite the story and let's find empathy for everyone that was involved, especially yourself. And that's just a little bit more challenging work to go do. But if anyone's interested in that, Instagram is probably the easiest way to get. And there's like a contact button so people can like hit the contact button. I think it emails us, sends a text message, I think, as well. So that's probably the easiest way.
Well, that is
great to know. I plan to chase that down and bring my teenage son and myself, in the very least, if not the whole crew.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Cool. Well, Hugh, yes, as we are wrapping up, I want to express my deepest gratitude. You've taken just my own personal raw experience right now. You've taken me on a beautiful roller coaster today of like weaving so many amazing thoughts and principles and truths through this whole conversation. Heather already spoke. I love that Heather said that, mentioned one of your superpowers as being able to hold space. But I, about halfway through our conversation today, I just really had this really powerful knowing myself that I'm like, I think this is before we even got into like a superpower conversation, but I just had this cool impression of, I think Hugh has a superpower of just being able to really present truth in such a powerful way that just resonates so naturally and beautifully. Every experience that I've had with you so far as of yet has been that, and that's been consistent. And that's not to put you on a pedestal. I just want to honor the gifts and the strengths that you bring to the table and how that has deeply enriched my life. And I could probably speak for all of us, but I believe that's really enriched all of our lives today. And I'm praying that that has enriched everyone that's listening to our podcast today. And thank you for sharing with us how we can stay in contact with you, and definitely recommend you guys reaching out to him or following him on Instagram. This has been so beautiful. So much could be said. We could probably sit here for 5 hours and not be tired of talking with you. But yes, we are very grateful for all of the insights and the wisdom that you have brought. Lots of deep things to chew on. So I'm gonna have to come back and re-listen to this like 5 times just to like get more and more downloads and more insights. And that's a really good sign of somebody that can teach powerful wisdom. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And you bring up a really good point too. I don't jam people. I don't fill their day from like 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. at our retreats, because these are big things that you got to chew on and go look at. And so we have paddle boarding and we got a little beach and kayaking and fishing and hiking. And we have a whole, you've seen our little animal zoo that we have out there, a little petting zoo. We get little miniature Highland cows and miniature goats and fainting goat. I mean, we've got like a cool little thing, but we utilize all of that for people to find silence and stillness within, because that's where your inner knowing really comes from. We're so hardwired to go do, and what we need are opportunities that model and template us on how to be. And because once you can just sit with you in silence and stillness, what you end up getting is all the clarity of what needs doing. And then now you're out doing things that need doing. So we do hold a really good space that's not jammed packed with activities, almost as like a form of distraction. We're kind of like we're not a full silent retreat by any means, but we really lean into a lot of the quiet time, the stillness and the silence, giving you time to just go enjoy nature and to get back in tune with you. That's definitely a big element of our retreats.
I think that's such a powerful element to the work that you do. Me and my own personal work with my own self, as you spoke about your own work, right? The work I've done with myself has happened in those moments when I've sat with myself in silence or in nature, or I've been to retreats that are not the hustle and the bustle and the dopamine kick, right? Where it's like they carve out time for you to sit in the uncomfortable stuff, and it's uncomfortable, but those are the transformative spaces, and that's what my soul longs for. And so I think the work you do is beautiful.
Thank you.
So any last thoughts, Amy and Heather, before we wrap up? Okay, beautiful. Hugh, thank you from the bottoms of our hearts to yours. We are so grateful for your time today. Thank you for joining us.
Likewise, thank you.
From our hearts to yours, thank you for joining us today on this episode of the Journey of Wholeness podcast. We are so grateful for you. We believe in you. If you'd love more of this great content, please consider subscribing. We'd love to support you even further by you joining our Facebook group community called The Journey of Wholeness, where we talk about principles to help empower and transform your life along your journey of wholeness. You can find out more details at thejourneyofwholeness.com.